by Vachon. How does the French say Vachon? This is the Brown Briefly, where less is more, more or less, coming to you live over KVSH 101.9 FM, Voice of Vachon, your island connection. Please make us part of your day. And be advised that our assertions and views, which can modestly be described as progressive persuasion, do not in any way reflect the opinions of KVSH or Voice of Vachon.
And, of course, that was the voice of our late friend Brian Brown, creator of the Brown Briefly. You know, Brian started the Briefly and brought with it his high standards of hosting an intelligent discussion of current events. It was always laced with humor and empathy. And Brian's central concept was less is more, more or less. And he often, always, I'll say it, offered more. So, hey, today is, let me give you an introduction to the Brieflies. Sitting next to me here in the Gene Boss studio is my airplane partner and fellow treetop aficionado, arbiter, mediator, two-time Fulbright, high-end women's shoe salesman, that's my favorite, Binkerton guard of the Pan Am's first 747, a former tort law professor, and Washington State Assistant Attorney General, Mr. Craig Ballas. Good morning, Craig.
Good morning, Truman. Good morning, Brieflies. I'm going to have to make up some new stuff, and we can rewrite that.
Well, I don't know. I'm kind of enjoying it. Zooming in from his home above KVI Beach is the historian extraordinaire, skipper of the Vashona, president of the Vashon Heritage Museum, and our own globe-trotting guardian of the galaxy, Mr. Bruce Hallman. Good morning, Bruce.
Good morning. Good to be here. Good to be here on a morning that's not quite so hot and dry.
Yes, indeed, indeed. And by the way, that is a great background you have there. Can you tell us what it is?
Yeah, for the Brieflies who don't have visuals, which is everybody except us, it's actually a photograph taken in the sort of early 1920s from the port of Tacoma.
Oh. So
that's the... the Tacoma City Hall behind you, and then a tramp steamer on the docks down where the Seaport Museum is right now. And the boat coming out is the SS Vashona, the steamship that served the run between Tacoma and Burton from 1922 until the late 1930s.
Fantastic. Yeah, I'm sorry you folks that are listening can't see that. It's a great photograph. I really appreciate that. And zooming in from somewhere, we're not sure where, aboard his yacht, the Opus, is a voice of Indivisible Vachon and the Vachon Climate Action Group, our indefatigable defender of democracy who strives to create a livable planet overseen by a government that we can appreciate or at least tolerate, Mr. Kevin Jones. Good morning, Kevin.
Hey, that's me. I'm glad to see I'm visible today, not invisible.
Yeah, well,
we that photo in Bruce's background, we are just right down the dock from the Lady Washington here in what I would call the maritime center, the heartbeat, maritime heartbeat of the San Juan Islands, Friday Harbor.
Oh, fantastic. Island. Yeah, what a wonderful spot. I've been there many times in the past. Great spot. I'm Truman O'Brien. I'm the sitting here behind the big red switch in the Gene Bosch studio in beautiful downtown Vashon. They always introduce me as being a West Texas, is it devotee? Is that the word
I think
they
devotee,
use?
Aficionado, one or the other.
You know, I'm originally from West Texas and then moved to Eastern Montana, which is a real culture
shock.
Now,
why is it West Texas,
well,
and
because,
Eastern Montana.
Well, because it's not East Montana. That doesn't work.
It doesn't, because nobody ever says it.
Nobody ever says it. And you can't say Western Texas. That sounds weird.
Well, that's because nobody ever said it.
Well, that's it. That's it. You see? That's it.
But we could change that whole paradigm.
We could. Right here on the Briefly. We could do it.
But they do say Western Montana.
They do say Western Montana. Isn't that interesting?
No figure.
I never thought of that. And you know what? They say East Texas. They don't say Eastern Texas.
It's a north-south divide.
I wonder about that. That's got me. Now you got me thinking. See what you did?
Have you got an expert on American geography?
Actually, I have an expert on the on the words that we use.
I know.
And that's Christy the wordsmith.
Well, and she's from Montana, so she might have an opinion on that.
I will send her a note as we speak. That's a great idea. hey, today is the 25th of July. In 1837, the first commercial use of an electric telegraph was successfully demonstrated by William Cook and Charles Wheatstone between Euston and Camden Town in London. How about that? 1837. Can you imagine?
That is early.
Yeah, look what we've done in that
small
amount of time. I find that fascinating. I see Bruce is chomping at the bit.
Well, Euston and Camden must be, what, mile and a half apart?
Exactly. Yeah, right. I know. I think that's great. Well, it's kind of like when Edison that said, come here, Watson, or whatever it was? You know, I mean, he was virtually in the next room. You know, but all right, so in 1850, gold was discovered right here in Oregon on the Rogue River. I never knew that before. Here's a big one for you and me, Craig. 1909, Francis Louis Berlioz made this first aircraft flight across the English Channel. Now, just imagine, this is only 5.5 years after the Wright brothers' flight, which was in December 17th of 03.
And how long was that flight in distance?
Oh, it was like feet.
It was like, what, 40 feet or something?
Oh, no, it was a little further
100
than that.
100 feet.
Yeah, but it lasted like 46 seconds or something, you know. And here, 5.5 years later, this guy's flying across the English Channel. I think that's remarkable. Those two events, that 1837 with the telegraph and flying across the English Channel.
What is that great statistic about the landing on the moon is closer to the first flight by the Orville, you know, whatchamacallit?
Yeah, the
Wright brothers. Yeah, that would be them.
Yeah, yeah.
The Wright brothers. Than we are to it, you know. Now.
Yeah. It's astounding to me.
Yeah. Did that make any sense whatsoever?
No, I understood what you were saying because I read that statistic. That's the only reason.
But Truman, you got me thinking now. You got to wonder how many people tried to get across the English Channel by air and didn't make it.
I think there were a few actually. It didn't make it. Yeah.
Oh,
you're blipping out.
Yeah,
you're
there's got to be a few attempts, you know.
Oh, I'm sure there was. All right, I got a couple of Seattle-centric things here. In 1969, 70,000 people attended the Seattle Pop Festival. It lasted across 3 days, of course. But performers include Bo Diddley, Flying Burrito Brothers, 10 Years After, Guess Who, some Santana, Tim Buckley, The Byrds, Ike and Tina Turner Review, Chicago Transit Authority, which of course later became just Chicago, Chuck Berry, Led Zeppelin, and The Doors all performed here in Seattle, 1969. Where were you in 1969, Craig?
I was at the University of California, Santa Cruz. During the summer, I think I was selling high-end female women's shoes.
All right. I can see how you'd want to miss this then for that. Yeah.
No, but I spent my summers in San Francisco at my brother's house in the Haight-Ashbury.
So. Oh, there you go. And in 1993, the romantic comedy Sleepless in Seattle was released. Of course, that was starring Tom Hanks and Meg Ryan and directed by Nora Ephron. Anyway, that was a great movie. For those of you who didn't see it. Let's go around the horn here and see what folks were doing this last week. How about you, Kevin? I kind of got an idea of what you were doing this past week.
Last time we reported in from Sydney, British Columbia, not Sydney, Australia, just in case people needed to get that geographic area pinpointed for us. Appreciate the reference to Down Under. So since then, we crossed over the strait and into U.S. territory. So now we're in the San Juan Islands. We had a wonderful couple of days anchored in Garrison Bay. And you can visit Garrison Bay by boat or by land. It's the site of the English camp as the boundary dispute was raging between the U.S. and Canada and fomented the only violence, I believe, was the killing of a pig.
I was just going to say, was that the pig wars? Yeah, I'll be darned.
Yeah. Now it turns out that five or six British Canadians lost their lives during the stay there. A couple of them drowned offloading material off of a barge, and they're buried up on the hill, on Young Hill. So if you arrive either by boat or by foot, you can walk up to the cemetery and then hike up to the top of Young Hill and get a great view of northern San Juan Island. Highly recommended.
Cool. Cool. So how about you, Bruce? Anything exciting this week?
Well, last night there was just this incredible rainbow. If you're on Facebook, you can probably pop in and see some photographs. Ben Davidson took an amazing photograph from Inner Quartermaster Harbor, and it's a double rainbow. The second one is a little difficult to see, but it's a rainbow, but it's also reflected almost entirely in the water. So it makes a full circle. Very spectacular, but the rainbow in Tramp Harbor, it looked like it was landing right in the middle of Tramp Harbor. And it was, rainbows are usually relatively narrow. This thing was probably 4 or 5 times broader than typical rainbows that you see.
Wow.
And as the light was changing and the sort of water in the air was shifting around, it just got brighter and brighter until, and then bam, within 5 minutes, it was gone.
Gone, yeah.
But it was spectacular.
That's amazing. I've seen a few rainbows from altitude, as an airline pilot, and those rainbows are full circles, which is a little different to see that you see from the ground. But yeah, very interesting. Yeah, I saw those photographs on Facebook. They were fabulous. Wow, really great. So how about you, Craig?
No rainbows here.
No
No
rainbows.
rainbows. When you talk about double rainbows, aren't you supposed to kind of go, hysterical and scream about? There's that famous recording of the fellow who saw the double rainbow and he went nuts. Later on, I think he confessed to being on some kind of hallucinogenic drug.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised.
No, nothing quite so romantic for me. Although I had a great day on Saturday, as a member of the of CERT, the Community Emergency Response Team. We had a search and rescue exercise in the Island Center Forest. We divvied up into teams and went looking for an individual who had been hiding in the woods as part of our team, and to find that. So that was about 4 hours of Saturday. That was very, very educational and really got our ducks in line. And on that same point, I do want to let people know that if they're interested in participating in CERT, the Community Emergency Response Team, there's going to be training starting on September 10th. Sunday, September 10th. And if you're interested, email Jan Milligan. Jan Milligan is the director of CERT on the island, at CERT, which is CERT. I shouldn't have said at. That'll confuse people. CERT@vashonbeprepared.org. CERT@vashonbeprepared.org, and let her know that you're interested, and she'll send you some more material, and you can figure out whether or not you want to do that. But it's a great service to the island.
And if you ever get lost in the woods, do not wear your CERT gear, whatever you do.
Jim was making reference to
when we spent 6 hours in the woods,
waving at helicopters.
And when the helicopters flew
over, we were the rescuers.
Speaking from experience,
exactly. Yeah, exactly. Well, I didn't have much of an exciting week. I did do one thing that was kind of fun, and I'm now, to be perfectly honest, I'm not sure if it was this week or last, but I got a chance to fly in a de Havilland Beaver. We have one based at the, well, it's actually based over on Boeing Field, but two of the owners live on or have airplanes at the at our little municipal airport. And I got a chance to go up with Guido Perla and his Beaver, and that was a lot of fun. And one of the things I did was I came back later and I brought my drone out. I took some photographs of the airplane. It's really a great classic airplane, and I superimposed that photograph of the airplane on a couple of aerial shots that I had, And so you see the airplane flying over Vashon. It came out pretty cool.
You're good at that. You're very good at that.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, I sent it over to Guido. He was pretty impressed.
I bet he was. Hey, I had one other thing I forgot to mention.
Yeah.
When I was talking about if you're interested in CERT, if you're interested in that area and you'd rather do something a little different, the Voice of Vashon has its emergency alert team.
Yeah.
And you can join the emergency alert team. We need volunteers for that as well. And if you're interested in that, the email you want to send your interest to is info@voiceofvashon.org. info@voiceofvashon.org.
And I tell you, those folks do an absolute bang-up job. They're on top of anytime there's a ferry delay or a road closure or whatever, they're Johnny on the spot. I'm really impressed with them. Yeah, Bruce.
Yeah, let me throw in a pitch for MERT, M-E-R-T.
Oh, yeah,
which
right.
The Marine Emergency Response Team, organized out of Quartermaster Yacht Club. And it's a group of boaters that essentially are organized to go check in on isolated communities that are cut off from land access, but are open to marine access. And so we've set up basically, I think there's around 27, 28 communities around the island that are waterfront communities. And we set it up with two boat systems. So there's a larger boat that sort of sits offshore with a relatively high mast that can radio signal can reach the emergency center at the fire district. And then a smaller boat that runs up on the beach and checks in with people, takes supplies, bring people out if they need it, whatever. So it's another one of those. If you love being on the water and if you want to be part of this CERT, MERT, Emergency Operations Center kind of thing, it's a great way to get involved.
That's fantastic. Kevin?
So, Bruce, maybe we ought to propose to the MERT leadership some kind of a Dunkirk-esque banner or something, Burgeon.
Right.
On those boats. Yeah, yeah. We'll have to consider that.
We will.
And Craig, I guess we could form ERP. No, I guess that wouldn't work. I was thinking aviation. or burp or something. I don't know.
burp,
maybe. I don't know. But actually, all kidding aside, the Vashon Municipal Airport will be an incredible asset should we have the big one and the ferries aren't able to run. Working with the folks at the yacht club and the marina and the aircraft, we're going to be able to move a lot of people and materials on and off the island should the need arrive. So, a couple of local items. The Voice of Vashon Thrift Day Shopping Spree is still underway for a few more days yet. The latest word I got, I think we're about $3,000 short of our goal. So if you see someone selling raffle tickets out in front of Thriftway on Friday or Saturday, be sure and come up. And you can buy one ticket for $20 or five for the price of four. That'd be $80. And you get a chance to win a shopping spree at Thriftway. And that's a three-minute shopping spree. And they video it every year. And it's great fun watching those folks tear around the store and collect items in their bag. In their cart. You can have two runners going out ahead of you, pointing out stuff, and you can plot out your route as you go around. I think they got over $2,100 or something.
Yeah, I think for the last several years, people have gotten upwards and over $2,000 worth of, and with inflation, they may even start approaching a higher price.
Yeah, I'm sure.
By the way, if you want to come by and say hi on Friday morning, I'm going to be out there selling tickets at 9 o'clock.
All right,
I'll let you get by me without buying one if you've already bought one.
Only if you've already bought one. All right. Yeah.
But then, Craig, I assume there's no inflationary pressure on the price of the raffle tickets, right?
No,
they've been $20.
That's right. Since
forever.
Day one.
Yeah.
There you go.
What a bargain.
Right. It's a bargain. It's a bargain. Hey, speaking of food and the like, any of you folks had a chance to shop at the Solaria? I'm going to say that right. Solaria Farm Stand over in the well, what we used to call Clown Town, but I guess they don't call it that anymore. But
well, across from the library
there? Yeah, across from the library there. So anyway, if any of you folks had a chance, well, of course, you've been gone, Kevin. You haven't been there since they started selling.
I'll have to check it out when I get back.
Yeah. Oh, definitely do.
They don't let me out of the house, so I have not.
Oh, you haven't?
I have not.
No. How about you, Bruce?
No, I'm not allowed to shop for food.
Oh, my gosh. Am I the only guy that's been there?
Well, tell us about it.
Well, I'll tell you about it. You can buy absolutely wonderful corn for like $1 an ear, which I think is pretty darn good. Mm-hmm. And it's superb, mm-hmm. just superb. I had one of the best cantaloupe that I've had in a long, long time. Where I grew up is not too far from Pecos, Texas. And the Pecos, Texas cantaloupe are, in my mind, the premier cantaloupe in the world. I mean, they are just beyond belief. And this one came right in there as a close second. Mm. I mean, very, very good. So here's a plug for the Solaria Farms. Yeah, Kevin?
I have to say, buying corn from a farm stand is a favorite pastime of mine. I do remember we were going out on our boat here, Susie and I, and my in-laws, or my sister-in-law and her husband, and decided we needed some corn. So there was a farm stand right where I worked, and we were out like for, 5 days, and I figured we'd have about 2 ears of corn per day. So you can imagine how much corn I brought to the boat.
Yes.
And we were looking for places to stow corn on the cob and all kinds of nooks and crannies on the boat. The other quick story I have is I was riding my bike home when I was doing bicycle commuting and went by the same farm stand to pick up, 4 ears of corn because it would be great for dinner. And as I'm packing those into the pockets of my jersey, the guy looks at me and says, "So you're going to be eating that on the ride home? Is that right?"
Yeah, munching them on the way home. Well, listen, hey, you two being boaters, I have a recommendation for you. This is no kidding. Take that ear of corn and you can slice it into like 1-inch slices, across the grain, and put those guys in a little aluminum foil with some butter and stick it on the Barbie. That's a fabulous way to eat your corn. And then you can eat them, just eat it around the edges there. It's really great. So there's a recommendation for you. Okay. So, hey, next item up. So we have the levy vote coming up, Proposition 1 for the Vashon Island Fire and Rescue. We've had people on with the first the cons and then the pros of passing the levy. Any of you folks have an opinion or any further thoughts on the levy? Don't all jump
well,
in at once.
Well, having interviewed one side of that, I'm trying to stay out of the fray from a personal standpoint.
Yeah.
I guess maybe an observation. Initially, I kind of thought that the individuals who were for the levy were characterizing their opponents as being against the fire department. Although I think they've made it clear that they are supportive of the fire department. That's not their problem. The opponents in characterizing the people that support it basically are arguing you're too trusting of the fire administration.
Yeah.
I've heard that. If you support it, you're agreeing that whatever the fire department wants, the fire department should get. And they're saying you got to explain to us how this money is used. I think, let me just say this, in light of the circumstances that we've run into worldwide this summer, yeah, with the fires all over the world, I think that will assist the people that are in favor of the proposition. I was just looking in the news yesterday about the island of Rhodes.
Oh, yeah.
The island of Rhodes is not a big island. I've been to the island of Rhodes, and There's a town there called Lindos. Lindos is where the Guns of Navarone was primarily filmed. It's gone.
Really?
I mean, it is the only thing that's standing almost is the castle that's on top of the hill there. The fire just swept over that island.
Wow.
And Greece is just taking it on the chin.
Well, I know they're evacuating people like crazy out of there, tourists and everyone else.
Right off the shore, speaking of which, the very thing we were talking about a minute ago.
Exactly. So. You know, for me, I think one of the things that I find really that is confusing to the general public is the 6% thing. And what's I think that the fire department needs to advertise or to point out is that the $1.50 that you're voting on does not change. That stays $1.50. And the only thing that 6% does is it allows them to increase the dollar of value as property values increase on the island. Obviously, the $1.50 doesn't increase because they're stuck with the amount of money that they get the first year of the levy. And that 6% just allows them to bump that amount of money up by 6% rather than the regulation of 1%, which everyone else has to abide by. So the citizens are agreeing to increase that dollar amount by that 6%. And that helps hedge inflation is what it does. So I think that's very confusing to people. And that part of it, I really think they need to further clarify. The other part of, yeah, Kevin, go ahead.
Let me jump in after your other next thought there, Truman.
Well, the only other thought I had was that, you know, they're talking about the Burton Fire Station. I was a volunteer firefighter years ago, and that was my station. And I had lunch with the fire chief recently, and I said, hey, well, you know, what's the deal? I mean, I don't see how you guys are going to be able to do that. He said, oh, we're going to move in a portable that'll go right next to the building. They've got hookups for sewer and water and power, everything, and it'll be a spot where the people who man that station, or I should say person that station, will be able to stay. So they'll have 24-hour coverage at that station, and that makes sense, being able to get people quicker to the south end of the island makes a huge difference, I think. But anyway, Kevin, yeah, go ahead.
I just also wanted to follow up that, you know, I really appreciated the fact that people are stepping into this conversation and that, you know, we have that opportunity to bring those voices right to our listeners. But the thing that really kind of struck me was the discussion about, you know, who has the credibility of doing the planning and figuring out exactly all the details, right, that go behind this decision, which is really important. And in the discussion last week, it was, could you staff the Burton station? Well, yeah, we could. Mm-hmm. But then you don't have enough people for an engine crew at the main station.
Right.
And it's like, oh, yeah, that's probably important. So, you know, there's a lot of information flowing around. People should listen carefully, in my view. But I'd really appreciate the fact that, you know, we had the folks last week were able to kind of maybe bring a little bit more information forward about some of the options and the choices that we're looking at.
Indeed. Indeed. Bruce, any comment?
The important thing is that people get out and vote.
Absolutely.
No matter which way you vote, get out and vote. But for me, it's sort of, it's response time. And in terms of, you know, for us who have lived on the island, even 30, 40, 50 years like me, we've not seen a brush fire, a significant brush fire on Vashon. But if you've gone through the newspapers like I have up until the 1960s, it was common every summer for brush fires to burn huge segments of the island. And we're just living in a fantasy world if we don't think that's not going to happen at some point in the future. And then the other thing is sort of, you know, talking about response time, the difference between a 3-minute or 5-minute or a 7-minute response time, you know, for a house fire or for a brush fire, you know, significant but not overwhelming. But if you're having a cardiac
event, you bet.
3 minutes, you know, a 3 or 4 minute difference is the difference between life and death.
Absolutely.
And so it's sort of like, wait a minute, you know, what do we value here? And that's sort of, that comes to me is what, you know, we live in a society where we can afford emergency response. Many people can't, but we can. And so, my sense is we ought to have as good of an emergency response as possible.
Absolutely. I agree. And I can tell you, for someone who's flown over the island many, many times, you look at how much vegetation there is on this island in between buildings. And I mean, it is incredibly rural. And if we had a major fire going, we would have our hands full. Yeah, Kevin.
Yeah, and I wanted to kind of follow on another thought relative to what Bruce said. We don't have the luxury of other people coming to our aid. And you can always argue that, wow, it's expensive to live on an island, but it is, you know, and be able to preserve public safety in a situation like a medical response that could be fatal, then, you know, is it worth that extra premium? Because we're not, or a brush fire that can escalate where we don't have the quick response, right, from off island with the ferries in the way. So, yeah, it's a good question. Appreciate the dialogue here as well. Good comments.
And a perfect segue into my next topic, which is, I wrote on my notes here, does anyone have anything to say about the ferry system that doesn't use one of the seven words, which is not allowed to be used on the radio as of late?
Sure, I do. Yeah. I'd like to say bleep. Oh, sorry.
Sorry.
I couldn't find the proper word.
Yeah, there you go.
Indefatigable.
Yeah, that word. Yeah.
And what I can say is, we occasionally get where we have Wi-Fi and then we can hook up and check emails and so on. And it's interesting for me to see the volume of WSF emails and how they correlate with weekdays versus weekends. But it seems like Strawberry Festival weekend was not well served by the services.
Well. And I'll tell you, you know, the other one that I recently saw was a bunch of folks who were coming from the Taylor Swift concert. And of course, they got out of the concert late and they arrived at the ferry dock and they canceled the last sailing.
Hard to get away from that.
I know, flights are, yeah, I'm stuck with it. But they canceled the last sailing. And here are these people, they got kids
with them.
Stuck on the
dock.
Yeah, and they're stuck on the dock. And boy, you know, I mean, gosh, it just seems like there's got to be a better solution.
Well, somebody suggested that the ferry system supply kayaks and
there you go,
and rowboats and whatnot in those kinds of circumstances.
Exactly. Oh boy. Well, anyway,
it's also, if I can jump in, I mean, this is nothing new.
Of course.
When you look at newspaper reports and when you look at the issues around ferries and steamers before there was a ferry system, and I mean, the whole reason Vashon formed its own ferry district in 1948 was problems exactly like this. The island just said, hey, we're done. We're going to create our own ferry system. And they ran it successfully for, what, almost 5 years until the Washington State ferry system was put in place. And then that was going to solve all the problems. And the Washington State ferry system was going to solve the problem because, as the governor at the time stated, this is a temporary solution until the bridges are built. They were going to have bridges. They were going to have five bridges across Puget Sound.
Right.
You know, Tacoma Narrows Bridge, Vashon Bridge, bridge at the north end of Bainbridge Island, a bridge at Apple Tree Cove, and a bridge up at Port Townsend. So the ferries were a temporary solution. And here we are, what, 70 years later, and we're still living with a temporary solution.
We want just the right amount of transportation to the island.
Exactly.
Not too much
right. And
not too little.
Exactly.
Right. It's
exactly.
That sweet spot.
The Goldilocks syndrome.
There you go. You know, the one thing I do find really disconcerting is the fact that many of these problems now are personnel versus mechanical. You know, when they can't crew, you can't get enough crew to operate the thing, that seems to me like that's got to be a fixable problem, you know. I mean, I understand old boats and boats breaking down, but personnel, I don't necessarily buy it.
But it's also, I mean, it's also a demographic problem. Mm-hmm. I mean, the ferry system is not the only one dealing with this. I mean, you look at police, you look at fire, you look at highway patrol, you look at service industries, look at UPS. I mean, UPS right now has just settled a contract because they can't get enough employees, you know. And so they're, you know, what you're seeing as a result, I think it's a result of the pandemic, is the same thing you saw at the end of the Black Death. There was a rebalancing of the power between those who control and run the economy and the people who work in the economy. And the Black Death, it was basically the serfs began to demand payment for their work. You know, right now you're seeing labor saying, hey, we're not going to work for minimum wage.
So the ferries problems are comparable to the Black Death? Is that what I'm...
Yeah, well,
is that what
very close, very close, yeah.
Throws out of the same syndrome, right?
Well, we have budgetary issues, of course, too. You've got people all over Washington who never been on a ferry and just don't understand the concept of the ferry being the highway system, right. And don't think it's cost effective. And the people that are, you know, privileged and entitled and live on islands should pay their way, and we shouldn't have to pay for them. And then we get into the whole, we pay for your roads and we pay for your, you know, plows and all of that sort of thing. So it's a never-ending story.
Yeah, Kevin.
Well, I don't know how this kind of goes beyond maybe this ferry service question, but reading Canadian papers has been interesting. One of the challenges that they're now facing is, you know, how do we make sure that we have an effective labor force, right, for the country? And they just relieved some of the restrictions on people coming in from Hong Kong, which I suspect is probably also a political question, right, regarding Hong Kong's demise of their democracy. But they did the math, you know, they started to calculate, you know, what kind of costs were affiliated with not having a workforce. And these are kind of costs we're paying, right? Costs in lack of service, but there's also real costs of having to pay more for higher labor rates to attract people into those jobs, folks who would maybe rather figure they can get along without that paycheck. So interesting dilemma. Of course, our country, our island is aging, and we're going to have to face that question as well.
You know, the state of Montana just recently passed a law. They were restricting foreign doctors from practicing in the rural communities. And they recently just passed a law that said, hey, yeah, you know, it's okay for them to go, because they had no health care. You know, there weren't doctors who were willing to go out into the boonies and to provide care. And so they had to make those adjustments. I can see those sorts of things happening, you know.
Yeah, it's kind of the creation of what are often called food deserts, mm-hmm. or you know, medical deserts or fairy deserts. You know, they're sort of the same problem. You know, and it's kind of intractable right now, but ultimately, you know, a solution will emerge, but it's gonna cost.
And you know, the thing that strikes me too is that with the pandemic, we had a number of people who suddenly said, wow, you know, I can get by without doing those things. And it kind of made them realize that they were, you know, kind of getting along better than they anticipated that they would without doing that work.
Well, so, and you also look at the way the pandemic affected the commuter population of Vashon. Mm-hmm. People working from home, people telecommuting. I mean, you know, if you saw, Alice Larson did a talk last week on the demography of Vashon. She had some just amazing statistics from the ferry system about usage. And it just, the use of the walk-on ferry collapsed in 2020.
Really?
And it's only back to about a third to a half of what it was pre-2020. And probably will never go back to what it was.
Right.
And so ferry systems got to balance that as well. Number of cars going on and off the island. I mean, it's really a fascinating sort of a problem that ferry planners and transportation, you know, labor planners are having to work with, because it's a different world.
And just think, it was only in 1837 that first telegraph. There we are. It all comes around full circle, doesn't it? Interesting. So on the national level, we all know, we lost an absolute legend in Tony Bennett on Friday. I'm just wondering, we had a whole show this morning that was paying tribute to Tony and the wonderful collaborations that he had over the years. But I'm wondering if you guys have any favorite songs or memories that, of Tony.
Mm-hmm. Well, I do have a favorite song. It's a song that I sang to my wife, to her great chagrin, at a party that we had for a landmark birthday of hers. And the way I learned to sing it was, there are many, many renditions of this song, but the one rendition that I liked the best was Tony Bennett's The Way You Look Tonight.
Oh, yeah.
So that would probably be my favorite.
Cool.
Yeah. I love it. I mean, late in his life, he did this series of recordings called Duets.
Yes.
And that's just, I mean, it's spectacular. And just, I mean, the best of the best, not only with him, but the people that he did duets with, and a wide range of musicians, and just showed that how special his voice was, because he could work with a range of musicians, and they're just very special to listen to.
We played I don't know how many songs from that Duets 2 album. The Duets 2, I think, is the one that is the most popular, but everything from jazz musicians to country singers. Willie Nelson, for example, you know, I mean, he sang with them all. And one of my favorite things was his final performance there at Radio City, where he and Lady Gaga, and right. Here he is with pretty severe Alzheimer's. And he came out, and when the lights hit and the orchestra starts, boom, he was alive and there. You know, just was so impressive. I just couldn't get over it.
Gives us all hope, right?
I guess so.
We can't remember what word we're looking for.
Exactly. Exactly.
Turn on the lights.
Don't stop the music.
That's right. Fire up the orchestra. You know, there's Amy Huggins here on the island started a program at Vashon Community Care. And I can't remember the name of the program at the moment, but it was Music Heals, that's it, yeah. And where she played music for the folks at VCC. And it was amazing to watch their eyes light up and them actually come alive when that music would play. Very, very interesting. And it sparked a lot of memory, activation from just listening to that music, which I thought was pretty amazing. So basically, I didn't say this part, but we have no a small talk guest today. And what we've kind of come up with as a plan is the last show of the month, we're going to kind of go back and do a recap of those items that we weren't able to cover in previous shows. And so, Bruce, one of the things you brought up was this killer heat that we've got in the Southwest right now. And the wildfire smoke in the Midwest and Northeast, torrential rains and flooding, and I'm surprised we don't have hordes of locusts coming as well.
We do have hordes of
locusts. Well, we do, actually. Yeah. In Utah, I think
right.
They have.
Yeah, it's grasshoppers.
Yeah, exactly. And the Gulf of Mexico, geez, up over, I think it was 96 degrees was one of the last.
Frogs we don't have.
Frogs. Well, actually, I did see there's another place where the road was squirming with frogs. So there you go. There you go. But so what do we think? Is this, as you said, is this the beginning of the ends of times or what? You know, what do you think?
Take it, Bruce.
Well, yeah, for me, it's really interesting to watch how climate scientists are sort of responding to this. I mean, the Gulf of Mexico is 100 degrees right now.
Coral being killed off left and right.
Yeah, right. And if you read in the papers this morning, this thing about the collapse of this mid-Atlantic circulation current, you know, this weakening, you know, significantly, and mainly weakening because of the onslaught of freshwater melt from Greenland in particular, and that circulation system is one of the great drivers of weather systems around the world. And so, you know, sort of how fragile, you know, this what we take for granted in terms of weather systems and patterns. And we're seeing, I mean, we're always at end times, right? but my sense is this climate crisis that we're facing right now is very serious. And I mean, some climate scientists are saying it's time to hit the brakes hard on CO2. You know, that we have 20, 30 years at most, and maybe less, before, you know, we go into a significant sort of global change that we may not be able to adapt to and keep the kind of culture and lifestyle that we have around the world. So yeah, it's that sort of, you know, I think for those of us in our senior years, it's sort of like, are we going to make it to see it, or are we going to check out before it happens?
Exactly.
You know, that's exactly. Sort of always the question. But when I look at my grandkids, you know, my 7-year-olds and my 10-year-olds, and I'm thinking, you know, by the time they're my age, what is the world going to be like? And that's very sobering.
Indeed. Kevin.
You know, you mentioned grandkids. One of the issues around climate concerns was that as a human, we only experience what's in our lifetimes unless we are historians. And therefore, while, you know, my parents and grandparents can probably remember, you know, more snowy days in Seattle, you know, I remember snowy days in Seattle, but probably not the extent to what they did. So, you know, we continually recalibrate our personal awareness of what normal is. Well, now, apparently more people now believe that climate will affect them seriously during their lives. And I think that in my mind becomes one tipping point that's really important. People, I think, have to see the threat and realize that it's impactful to them. The other tipping point, interestingly, talking to geologists about how, well, eventually things will just balance out. And my thought is that, you know, that's based on the history that we know, that eventually the carbon will leave the atmosphere when we keep putting it in. But will we be left in some operating point, you know, with ocean currents and jet streams that are really dramatically different than what we've ever been able to know about the planet? And what does that mean? So we go back to the fire department, right? There's those unknowns that we have to be aware of and do the best we can to plan for.
Yeah, you know, it's that classic at the beginning of the Great Depression, you know, Franklin D. Roosevelt and the Great Deal, the New Deal, it's a great deal too, but the New Deal, was talking with his agricultural secretary, Hopkins, and one of the economists they were working with was saying, well, in the long term, this is going to adjust and, you know, the prices will come back up. And Hopkins, I think it was Hopkins, turned and said, well, people don't eat in the long term, they eat in the short term.
There you go.
Kind of thing, you know, in the long term, geologically, this will balance out, but you're talking tens of thousands of years, you know, and it's sort of like, wait a minute, human lifespans are, you know, relatively
way
shorter
than that. You know, I read this morning, I've been reading the whole lithium mining and all of the issues around that, and I read this morning that they found a chemical or whatever in the shells, chitin. Anyway,
I don't think you can say that.
Well, I can't say the word. Yeah, whatever it is, but it's from lobster and crab that they're making batteries. There's a potential of making batteries using this material, and of course, it's incredibly abundant. All of the shells get thrown away from our harvesting, but they think that they can use all of that material and produce a battery that is 97% effective, efficient.
That brings up an interesting point. Mm-hmm. And that point is how much faith do we put in technology to be able to save us from our own indiscretion, our bad judgment? There's a topic here that has fallen on very hard times. And that's that a great deal of our problem is due to the fact that in, in 1960, we had 3 billion people on the face of the earth. And do you know how many people we have on the face of the earth today?
I do not.
Over 8 billion.
Right.
We've gone from 3 billion to over 8 billion between 1960 today.
Yeah.
That's a huge difference. And now they say we're going to add a billion about every 13 to 15 years. That whole discussion has fallen on somewhat hard times because Paul Ehrlich, the individual who wrote the books on this, predicted that we would all go to hell in a handbasket back in the 70s and 80s, and it didn't come to pass. So people thought, oh, you're yelling, you know, wolf here, screaming wolf too much. Although he is a distinguished professor at Stanford, and all of his findings were scientifically tested. The only problem is I think he's probably right. He just has a timing way off.
Yeah.
But the question is whether or not we're getting to a point where we will have to make radical changes in the way we live because we won't be able to change the climate anymore because we've done too much damage to it already.
So it's back to that all politics are local. All change in the environment is local. You have to look at what each individual is doing. Yeah. Bruce.
In part, was that Ehrlich's predictions were correct. I mean, what he didn't predict was the Green Revolution, you know, that sort of, you know, in a technological solution to the food problem. Well, I mean, that sort of lulls us into this sort of, well, what's the next technological solution? Is it going to be the chitin from lobster shells, or is it going to be electric cars or whatever? And at some point, you know, if you're a gambler, you realize you run out of options.
Right.
You know, luck ultimately catches up with you at some point. And that's the issue, I think. And what you're getting at, Craig, is sort of like, how much can we rely on these sort of unexpected, you know, technological solutions to come off and sort of save our rear ends for the next, you know, 20, 30 years. That's the issue.
Another example of that, I just read that they've come up with a new engineered banana, which has, you know, about like 3 times the amount of nutrition that a regular banana has. And they're talking about what it's going to do for third world countries in order to stave off famine. But yeah, Kevin.
We had a couple of boats moving, so I had to disappear for a second, but I don't know if you've mentioned the ultra white paint, which apparently does a very good job of reflecting the sun's heat energy back into space.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there's a huge grab bag of options. I think the challenge is, and you've probably already articulated this, is are they going to be here in time? And the one thing that we know we can affect is our amount of pollution that we put out. So those are the variables that we all know that we can, you know, grab onto those dials every day of the week.
Exactly. All right. So the next topic I've got is how about Florida's new teaching standard about slavery? Have you guys been reading about that?
Oh yeah.
Wow, what an opportunistic career that was, huh?
Oh man! Well, you know what?
Free training.
You know what? I mean, I know that that's true. I mean, I'm sure that there were slaves who gained technology, you know, gained skills. But the problem is they were not marketable because they were slaves, for crying out loud.
Oh, that's a classic. That's the way people have been dealing with these sort of issues for you know, millennia. Something good comes from evil.
Yes.
There's always something good that comes from evil. Let's focus on that rather than the basic problem. And that way we don't have any responsibility or we can feel good about the situation.
Exactly. Kevin.
Well, I have just finished reading Churchill's 4-volume set, History of the English-Speaking People. And Churchill was born in a time of British colonialism. And he was very much a fan of the empire. And you can read in his words where he believed that colonialism brought, much improved lifestyles of those populations.